For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. So for new people and people who haven't been here in a while, we're in the middle of a practice period for a couple of months, and Nyozan Erekshut is our shuso, or head monk for the practice period, and he's going to speak to us this evening. So thank you, Nyozan.
Thanks. If I can.
I think everybody, possibly with the exception of Steve, has probably heard Taigen at least once recently talking about this text that we're studying for this period of intensified practice, Mountains and Rivers Sutra, a piece of writing that by Dogen Zenji, our founder, that Gary Snyder, without any hyperbole at all, describes as an astonishing text. I'm going to be referring to that on and off throughout the talk, but this isn't really a talk about the mountains, rivers, per se. I just have to check something. When I picked the chant tonight, the harmony of difference and sameness, I did not remember at all this line. Progress is not a matter of far or near, but if you were confused, mountains and rivers block your way. It's really a great little coincidence or whatever. So maybe I'll talk about that, I don't know. So one of the things about the Mountains and Rivers Sutra by Dogen is that it's got this kind of, you know, the thing about the rabbit and the old lady with a bonnet kind of thing, that optical thing where you look at it and something comes to the foreground and something comes out and then the other side disappears, but then there's a shift. A lot of that happens in this text, except for in a couple of, it's like it happens in four dimensions or three dimensions or something. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. And so there's no question about, as Taigen says, you know, we're not going to get a total grip on it. But it's, looking at it is really illuminating, and I find very interesting, helpful. So I'm going to touch on a couple of pieces tonight. I guess another way to say that thing about the way, you know, this sort of foreground, background thing, is that there's lots of different ways you can go when you're moving around in the mountains. And so this is just one way. It's probably not the main way or a particularly important way, but I think it's an interesting way and a helpful way. So yesterday, Taigen quite appropriately to the text, you know, alluded to koan, or a saying by an ancestor named Qingyan. He says, "Before I studied Chan for 30 years, I saw mountains as mountains and rivers as rivers. But when I arrived at a more intimate knowledge, I came to the point where I saw that mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers. But now that I've got this very substance, I am at rest. For it is just that I see mountains once again as mountains and rivers once again as rivers." There's a natural complement to this kind of a way of thinking, I think. I've never heard it kind of put this way, except for possibly in the Oxfordian pictures that some of you know. But it is that first there is a person, then there is no person, and then there is a person. And I think that this has to do with what we call Dharma position. I'll explain that a little bit in a minute. But interestingly, Dogen, at the beginning, the opening paragraph that Taigen's read a few times, he mentions Dharma position. The translations we've been using don't use that term. I'll read the little intro, and this little intro sort of functions, I think, a bit like a pointer in the koans. You know, it kind of orients us. It doesn't tell us directly where it's going, but it it orients it. He says, these mountains and waters of the present are the expression of the old Buddhas. Each abiding in his own Dharma state fulfills exhaustive virtues. And he goes on about the self before the emergence of signs and so on. But what they talk about here is Dharma state. And I should clarify, I'm using another translation. There are many translations, and I find all of them useful in different ways. This is by the Soto Text Society, or Text Project. You know, they talk about Dharma state. Kaz Tanahashi talks about condition. Cleary talks about normative state. This guy, Hishu Kim, talks about Dharma situation. And I actually think that the most helpful way of talking about it is the one that Taigen uses all the time, which is Dharma position. Dharma position, as many of you know, I mean, that's part of that. So Hogetsu is our, among her many functions, she's our sewing teacher. Roy's our Eno. Nea is Doron tonight. So these are functions. But that's kind of a derived sense, you know, talking about Dharma position in the context of Sangha and functional roles that we fulfill. Taigen's a teacher. I'm being a Shuso. The more fundamental sense is the position of dharmas, and the position of dharmas in relationship to one another, and in particular for our practice, what's important for our practice is our relationship to all other dharmas, all phenomena. In the Mountains and Waters Sutra, one way in some sense, you know, I think Dogen is speaking absolutely literally in this, by his understanding in this text. I don't think he's writing an allegorical or a symbolic text, but it's really multivalent, and so that even though he's actually talking about real, you know, specifically mountains and waters, he's also talking about many other things. He's talking about practice. He's talking about mountains as mountains and rivers as the phenomenal world, the collection of all dharmas. So this thing of dharma positions, one way to think about it is, you know, it's a fool's errand actually to read too much into the pictographic content of Chinese characters, but sometimes it's illuminating. And in this case, the thing that's being translated or is expressed as position is the character or the glyph or whatever for a human being and standing, where a person stands. Here, Hoyi, Dharma position, where a person is standing in relationship to dharmas, to phenomena. At the start of Mountains and Rivers, Dogen says, you know, basically, we don't know. We don't have a clue. And actually, come to think of it, that's kind of consistent throughout. But there's a particular kind of way in which we don't know at the beginning. And this is, we don't understand dharmas because we don't understand ourselves. We don't understand ourselves because we don't understand dharmas. We misapprehend the kind of thing it is to be a human being. He says we don't understand our own walking because we've not understood the mountains walking. I have some notes, but I'm afraid they're not organized because I'm not organized. He starts out, you know, in the very earliest chapters, to those outside the mountain, says, although the walking in the blue mountains is faster than swift as the wind, those in the mountains do not sense this, do not know it. To be in the mountains is a flower opening within the world. Those outside the mountains do not sense this, do not know it. Those without eyes to see the mountains do not sense, do not know, do not see, do not hear the reason for this. To doubt the walking of the mountains means that one does not yet know one's own walking. It is not that one does not walk, but that one does not yet know, has not yet made clear this walking. So one way I'm thinking about this text is this, you know, the sort of sub-theme is it's like It moves from being outside the mountains to being inside the mountains, and in a sense to being outside the mountains again. And in this first phase, we're outside the mountains. We don't necessarily even have eyes. We don't understand ourselves because we don't relate properly to other dharmas, to other people, to other phenomena. And, you know, in the sort of the Buddhist way of thinking, that's because we have, you know, these karmic layers of greed, hate, delusion, etc. But in any case, we don't. So we have this idea, you know, the very scenario is that we are outside the mountains. We are distinct, separate. The mountains, all their phenomena, they're something else. It's us against them kind of thing. And I think a lot of us start out with that kind of understanding a little bit in these very subtle psychological ways. You know, but then we begin practice and we start to get a sense of non-separation, non-duality. We start to see the truth of dependent co-arising. I won't go down that path too far, but you know, we start to get a sense of that. The next, you know, there's a bit a little further on where, you know, Dogen's talked about being outside the mountains, and then he talks about not having eyes to see the mountains, and then he talks about when you're in the mountains, you know, when you have eyes and using them in a certain way. And he says, even when we have the eyes to see mountains as the appearance of grass, trees, stone, earth, fences and walls, it is not yet the complete appearance. Even where there appears an occasion in which the mountains are seen as the splendor of the seven treasures, this is still not the real refuge. Skipping ahead a little bit, even when we attain the crowning appearance of the vision of the mountains as inconceivable virtues of the Buddhas, their reality is far more than this. Each of these appearances is the particular objective and subjective result of past karma. They are not the karma of the way of the Buddhas and ancestors, but narrow, one-sided views. So, in this kind of, you know, in this sort of schema I'm laying out, we start to get a sense in our practice of, you know, that maybe we're not quite separate in the way that we thought we were. But we look at and talk about and analyze the Dharma in a way, in this sort of, as he says, subjective and objective ways. We treat it as something that's outside us, basically. And So in a sense, maybe there's been a bit of growth or a bit of development. It's still quite limiting. You know, and then he goes on a few paragraphs later to talk about this problem of objectification or reification in practice. He says, echoing, I would say, completely something that Wei Nung says in the Sixth Ancestor says in the Platform Sutra, turning the object and turning the mind is criticized by the great stage. Explaining the mind and explaining the nature is not affirmed by the Buddhas and ancestors. Seeing the mind and seeing the nature is the business of alien ways. This is straight out of Wei Nung. You know, again, he's continuing this theme of, like, there's this problem of distance and objectification and setting ourselves in some way apart, not only from phenomenon, but even from our own practice and our own understanding. And, you know, I just note, of course, that's, you know, what I'm doing here by talking in this way. But as this wise guy in Minnesota said, you have to say something. And so I'm doing my best, but I'm going to try and ground it later. Then later, I mean, there's all this wonderful talk about the flowing of water and stuff. And, you know, one of the themes is, one of the parts about this, all this talk about water, at some point he says, are we, when we talk about water, that's, you know, in fire, in the clouds, you know, in Buddha, and ancestors, are we talking about, are we talking about many things and giving it one name, water, or are we talking about one thing and giving it many names? And he doesn't, he raises that, he doesn't answer that. And I think what this has to do with is the non-graspability, ultimately, of dharmas. There's really no way to say. Why? Because dharmas, phenomenon, are empty, right? This has to do with, you know, going back to this introductory sentence where he talks about, you know, the self before the germination of any subtle signs. There are ultimately no characteristics, no signs that we can seize onto to separate one dharma for another. One way to talk about this is they don't obstruct each other. They're totally interpenetrating. So he goes on to develop these things, and here talking about, says it, you know, the highest formless realms, the Avicii hells, you know, they are in the same place. You know, Buddhas and sentient beings always appear together. You know, so there's this kind of thing. He goes on to, a bit later, to speak of, the disappearance, well, actually, he doesn't talk about the disappearance per se. He talks about we aren't able to meet anybody in the mountains. And in fact, we're not, when we're in the mountains, we're not able to see the mountains. And let me find this passage. From the distant past to the distant present, mountains have been the dwelling place of the great sages. Wise men and sages have all made the mountains their own chambers, their own body and mind. And though these wise men and through these wise men and sages, the mountains have appeared. However many great sages and wise men we are supposed to have assembled in the mountains, ever since they entered the mountains, no one has met a single one of them. There is only the expression of the mountain way of life. Not a single trace of their having entered remains. I think that this at least alludes to or suggests a part of the path of practice where the bodhisattva starts to, the practitioner can lose track of themselves in a certain way. They understand that they arise only in conjunction with absolutely everything else. And in some sense, they are a person, any dharma. You know, this image of Indra's mirror completely reflects everything else. So that there's ultimately no, you can't talk about them being different or the same. Hence my choice tonight, the harmony of difference and sameness. The sameness neither overrides the differences, but or negates them, but the differences don't in any way negate this other truth. But there can be, people can get lost in that emptiness. I don't want to get too much onto an excursus about this, but this actually parallels very much what happens in the ox herding pictures. If those of you are familiar with them, it's kind of an iconographic representation of the career of a bodhisattva or the path of a practitioner. And it starts out with, you know, the sort of clueless person, like looking around, searching for the ox, you know. The eighth stage, there are different ways of this is represented, but the eighth stage is this. It's labeled here, the ox and the man both gone out of sight. Here, you're not meeting the sages in the mountains, you're not even seeing the mountains. But this is a dangerous thing. We've been talking about Gary's, or it's a potential snag. We're talking about, you know, because you've lost your Dharma position, you don't know where you are. We've been talking about Gary Snyder a lot in connection with the mountains and rivers. He has a friend, Sakaki Nanao, a poet, Japanese poet. They lived in some islands in the southern archipelago in Japan for a while together. And I can't remember in what context, but I remember one time I read, you know, that in response to a question about environmental degradation, global warming, and all this kind of thing, Sakaki Nanao's response was, "No need to survive." That's a very, you know, that's true in a certain sense. But I would say we could think of that in terms of sort of getting stuck. You know, one way to put it is getting stuck in emptiness. We could say, I don't mean to criticize this guy, I don't know enough about him, but this particular statement, stuck in emptiness or privileging the, you know, some sense the what universal or the absolute at the expense of the relative. But in this text, Mountains and Rivers, Dogen goes on, and he, towards the end, he talks about one of our ancestors, Daechong. He says, "Long ago, when the preceptor Daechong suddenly left Yueshan and went to live on the river, he got the sage of Watang River." Kaz Tanahashi translates that God, he produced a successor. In other words, he meant a disciple. He says, "Is this not hooking a fish? Is this not hooking a person? A person? Is this not hooking water? Is it not hooking himself? That the person got to see Daechong is because Daechong was Daechong. Daechong's accepting the person is his meeting the person." So what I'm trying to convey here is that, you know, Daechong suddenly left Yueshan. Now that can have two references. It can either be his teacher by the name of Yueshan, so he went out on his own, or it could literally mean, and I think, you know, to resonate here a little bit, he left the mountains, he left the monastery, and he, in a sense, went back into the world. There's a note that I found, you know, that describes this a little bit. He's called the boat monk. Huateng Daechong, a student of the Chaodong master Yao Shen Wei Yan, resided on a boat, ferrying people across the river and teaching them Chan. One day, a young monk named Shan Hui came to seek out this monk for instructions. After some exchange of words, Daechong realized the potential of Shan Hui, so he posed a question to him. When Shan Hui tried to answer, Daechong knocked him out of the boat into the river and retorted, "Speak, speak." At this point, the young monk became enlightened. Daechong pulled him up and said, "Today, I finally have caught a big golden fish." The two stayed out all night on the river, sometimes talking, sometimes silent. In the morning, Daechong bade farewell to Shan Hui and left him on the shore. He said to him, "I studied under Yangshan for 30 years. Today, I have repaid his kindness. From now on, you will not need to think of me again." Then he rowed out the boat out into the middle of the river and tipped it over and disappeared without a trace.
Footnote to the footnote, that boatman left his teacher Yao Shan and left the monastery as a result of a persecution.
Right, I was going to... I'm sorry. So this is true. I mean, what actually happened, this was during the Anlushan Rebellion. Many monks and nuns were, as I say, laicized. The monasteries were closed, looted. They were sent back to the country. But, you know, out into the, quote, world. But I think in this case, with whether he left because he was driven out or not, he was out. And what does he do? He becomes a boatman. this is perfect story because, of course, this whole the earlier literature, there's this talk about getting to the other shore. So this becomes a guy who's, he's just out there in the world, and what's he doing? He's taking people to the other shore. And then he's going back, and then he's taking somebody else. We call these people, bodhisattvas. And so this is, what I'd like to try and claim here is that, or say, is that Daishong is an instance of somebody who has learned his own walking. He's learned the meaning of his own activity. He's learned the meaning of his own life. And it's all predicated, in a sense, on this earlier stage of this disappearance of self and mountains and others. There's a term that came up the other day, Anupadika Dharmakashanti, which Taigen translates as the ungraspability of things, or
patience
with the ungraspability of things. Which is great. A slightly more literal sense is, acquiescence to the non-production of dharmas. But the non-production, non-grasping, the non-production is because at a certain phase or whatever practice, the bodhisattva sees that there are no emergent signs. There is no way to distinguish one dharma from another. There's no way to distinguish samsara from nirvana. There's no way to distinguish self from other. So there's nothing to grasp. There's no way to do that. And then with that conviction that the dharmas are unproduced and empty, and void of characteristics that can be grasped, that's when it's said, that the bodhisattva acquiesces to the difficulty of saving others, even though there's a realization that ultimately there is no one saving any other being, there are no other beings to be saved. And this is the realization of the deep internalization of non-duality. But it involves taking up a dharma position. It involves getting into a boat and rowing people across. So it's like stepping out of the emptiness and taking on the tasks of acting wisely and compassionately for the sake of all beings. So we talked about, taking on our dharma position. And, there's this sort of very grand sense we're talking about here, Daishong is a great bodhisattva, but they're, in our practice, and I don't think this is actually a temporal process, but something that happens over time, we take on the particularities of our life with the spirit of a bodhisattva, with the spirit of trying to help others, trying to help all beings. So you could, for example, restore a prairie, you could be a counselor, you could take care of animals, you can raise a child, you could be a Zen teacher. There are any number of ways to do this, but it involves, at least for a person in practice, it involves changing, growing out of our sense of separation, because that is the impediment, that's the thing that reinforces this sense of a self, that as the early texts say, that's not something that can be. So we talked about the non-graspability of dharmas. The early texts say there's self that can be. What do they call it? Appropriated. I forget what word they use, but there's nothing to grasp on. So anyway, I think this is kind of a sub-theme of mountains and rivers. And, one final thing here, going back to the Oxfording pictures. So Daishong becomes the boatman. End of the Oxfording pictures. We have returning to the marketplace. place with gift bestowing, with bliss bestowing hands, a guy with a bag of tricks and goodies, fat. You know, so I really think that echo is there. So anyway, I'm sorry, that was very disorganized, but just some thoughts I had, and if anybody would like to comment, that'd be great. I'm sorry it was a little wonky, but but I think it's an important part of what, you know, one of the many, many things that's going on in this text.
Yeah.
Well, I really connected with this talk, even though maybe you think it was disorganized, but it was really helpful to kind of have it in that kind of piecemeal kind of thing for me. But the reason why I connect with it is because I think, like, I've lived in a lot of states and, you know, I've lived different groups of friends and whatever, and I always feel like I'm always, I like people, but, like, I feel like I'm always, like, they're this way and I'm this way. They're this way and I'm this way. And I don't think I've ever fully engaged or, like, dove into anything because I'm always kind of like, I'm not that type of person or, you know, like, I don't, you know, whatever. And even just, like, yeah, just, like, I know that that's not, like, the best thing, but then sometimes I'm like, well, you know, it kind of helps to be an inside-outsider. But then, I don't know. I guess I just feel like I'm at the point where I'm just realizing, like, I do need to kind of define myself in some way. And so, like, your talk coupled with, like, this is the first time I was Doan, and even while I was doing it, I was like, oh, you know, like, these forms and, like, who cares? And, like, you know, like, how does it matter, like, soft bells and big bells? And I just know that I kind of constantly have that kind of, like, dismissive separating thing where it's like, well, but then why do I keep coming back here?
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was even what you were talking about.
Well, you know, yes, it was, among other things. You know, for what it's worth, your doaning was at least as good as about the first 9 times that I did it. You know, so that makes you an insider. That makes us the same. Right.
Thank you. I enjoyed that. And I hear wonky is cool these days. So the idea of, you know, when you're first practicing, mountains and are mountains and rivers are rivers and all that, it brought to mind Dogen's other statement that, you know, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And then, you know, to be enlightened by all beings. And it feels like there's some parallels there of, you know, when we first approach things, it is that self and other duality. We sort of lose that in the 8th Oxfordian picture, where it just, everything feels absolute. And then in that final stage, my sense is that you don't just go back to the beginning, and that the final, you know, mountains and rivers are rivers also incorporates that middle section, that we're still empty, and that so sort of like to what you're speaking to, getting past that doesn't mean that ultimately you aren't sometimes kind of that outsider and other, and you can't still use that perspective. But you also can have other perspectives as well.
You know, I think you're right. It's not the same thing. The difference is, to use Dogen's language, is, you know, for example, Daishong, our other ancestors, they know their own walking. You know, you start out not knowing your own walking. They know their own walking. They know they walk in the context of, ultimately, of emptiness. But still, you know, we have to take care of things, right? We have to take care of each other. And actually, you know, going back to another thing that, that Tigan's talked about is, you know, it's interesting, you know, so we can talk about our own personal Dharma positions, these ways we take on being in the world, but it's also worthwhile talking about our collective Dharma position, you know, and how, you know, both how, you know, like a group like us, the Sangha, we relate to the Dharma, but also, you know, how we relate to the necessary tasks of the world. And those are different for, you know, just as people, different people's Dharma positions are different, you know, Dharma positions, say, of a Sangha may change over time. We're at a particular historical juncture, right, where it really is, if we want, you know, Sakaki notwithstanding, to survive, we do have to take on a different kind of responsibility and caring and love for phenomenon, the world. You know, sometimes, I mean, another way to talk about this whole text is we talk about, you know, we talk about different ways of relating to the environment. But I think that that kind of inscribes this sort of separation view, because an environment is what surrounds somebody or something. I think what we're really talking about is an ecology, you know, where, you know, the sequoia and the fungi at its roots are completely dependent on each other. And all things, it turns out, are like this, you know. So so it's important for us to step up to that as a Sangha, as individuals, as a culture. Maybe that's an opinion, but it's strongly held, at least.
Thank you very much. That's a good note to end on. It's time to end, but thank you. Yes, we are all in this Dharma position together, each in our own place. So we'll close with the four Bodhisattva vows on a little card. Chanting three times.
Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it.